1 o'clock at Must Be Open Mic on Boston Public Radio. All of the Bulger talk these days is about Whitey, alleged serial killer, set to stand trial, I think, in June. But through much of his career, our next guest focused his sights on Whitey's brother, Bill, state Senate president for about 20 years, till he was appointed UMass president by former U.S. attorney, then Governor William Weld. In a post on his website, radioopensource.org, I love this, a couple of years ago, Chris Lydon quotes John E. Powers, who preceded Bulger in South Boston politics and as the Senate president, quote, "It's as if Al Capone's brother was president of the Illinois State Senate and everybody pretended not to notice." Well, Chris Lydon never pretended. Welcome back, Chris Lydon.
Nice to be here, Jim. Good morning, Marjorie.
Well, make the case. Make the case that Billy Bulger got away virtually scot-free with one of the biggest pensions in state history.
First, the story isn't over. The case makes itself, Marjorie, I would say. I mean, if you just think about it. The two new books, which we should talk about, have infinite new detail about the horror story of Whitey Bulger, but they never address this great gaping question of who enabled him? Who gave him immunity? Why, from his teenage years, was he not arrested? He was not on trial since the mid-1950s.
You mean de facto immunity. You don't mean legal immunity. Is that
well,
correct?
The FBI gave him a kind of formal immunity, but everybody winked like he was part of the climate or something. Oh, that's Whitey. Everybody in the world dreaded Whitey, and not just because he was a bad guy, but because he had this kind of, he projected from those cold blue eyes a kind of, you know, these eyes go through steel, and I can do you, Jim, and I can get away with it. And he told that to so many, many people. The huge question still out there is, how did this happen? One of the things that comes through in the book, the Cullen Murphy book,
yep,
and the Lair O'Neill book, through both books, is that he had political protection from the beginning. I grew up in Boston. We used to joke that John McCormick, the Speaker of the House, had my father's long Irish ears. He looked like him, a classic sort of plain but straight, almost saintly South Boston guy. John McCormick was looking out for Bill Bulger in the Atlanta Penitentiary in the 50s and then the 60s. Whitey Bulger in the 50s, 56, I think, made his first agreement with Paul Rico of the FBI. I can deal with you. You'll get stuff from me. He had been double-crossed in a Rhode Island case. He said, okay, I can play this game. I'll double-cross and I'll talk to Paul Rico. So it goes on from there.
Wait a minute. Why was John McCormick looking out for Whitey, though?
Because Bill Bulger, college student, law student, was badgering him to, you know, my brother is in Atlanta and somebody didn't, you know, looked at him cross-eyed and I don't want that to happen again. And would you get on it? And John McCormick, you know, take care of the locals. These are the constituents. Got on a guy named
Billy. Was still a small fry at that point.
He was a kid.
Okay.
He didn't have a law degree, but he was an active kid and he was looking out for the brother,
okay,
and he putting it on McCormick's office. Get to the prison director, you know, I think it was James Bennett, and look after my brother. I don't want any harm to come to this guy. And that was a strong pattern through Atlanta, through Alcatraz, through many years. And then, of course, when he comes back out of prison in the early 70s, he adopts John Conley, then the intelligence chief of the FBI in Boston, and they play each other, giving information, getting information, becoming great friends. It comes to money. It gets hugely corrupted. I mean, serious money. $250,000 passed from Whitey to John Conley eventually. But the point was simply he had a cover, and it was a two-way street. But the books are even more interesting than that. I think they're interesting partly because we're seeing a kind of rebranding of who was Whitey, who is Whitey. Through that John Conley period, Whitey was just a kind of reckless kid from the neighborhood. But, you know, he wasn't that bad. He was what they called a good bad guy. He didn't do drugs. He kept drugs out of South Boston. As Mike Barnacle used to write endlessly, you know, don't worry about Whitey. He's leaving half the proceeds in the poor box at St. Monica's,
yeah,
or St. Augustine's.
That never turned out.
Yeah. Well, it's all total hogwash. We'll come back to the question of how the FBI manufactures story.
I'm more interested, by the way, rather than the FBI as protector, I'm more interested in his brother as protector.
Well, who assigned the FBI to look after my brother? In these books, it's not sort of documentary evidence, but the Lair O'Neill books explicitly says there are people, good people, good witnesses who say Bill Bulger talked to John Connolly and said, you could do me a favor. What's the favor? You could keep my brother out of trouble. That's sort of Bulger-ese for get with him. And further, there's evidence that Bill Bulger told Whitey, John Connolly wants to see you.
I want to talk about my experience with Bill for a second, then I want to get you to weigh in on Chris Lydon. My experience with Bulger is Bill is shorter than yours. It comes from when he was Senate president, and I was an alleged lobbyist on Beacon Hill. Every time something significant happened around his brother Whitey, there'd be a scrum of reporters outside the Senate president's office. But unlike I have ever seen with any other politician in my life, they'd ask one question about his brother. He would refuse to answer it, usually with some witticism, and there'd never be a follow-up question. I never saw that with a the story I tell, the day of the presidential debate with Gore and Bush at UMass was the day a body was found, some victim
they were digging up bodies
of Whitey's was found under 93 or something. The only reporter who this is a true story, who chased Bill Bulger around the UMass gymnasium to get him to answer a question was the reporter sitting between us.
That's true, Marjorie.
But what?
David Boeri wasn't there.
No,
he did
wonderful work too. I'm telling you, Marjorie. What was the thing with reporters and Bill Bulger?
Well, there was this famous story, and it's typical. Paul Corsetti of the Herald was on to this murder of a Louis Lettif, I think was his name, and there are various versions of it. But basically, he gets a call from Whitey. Says, I'm in a cafe in Faneuil Market. I'd like to see you. I'm in such and such a seat. He walks in and says, your name is Cossetti. My name is Whitey Bulger. I kill people for a living. And he said, and your wife gets on the turnpike here, or your kids go to school there. And enough already about you snooping around the Lettif case. Paul Cossetti went out and bought himself, a revolver, went to the Italian mafia to get a little protection from the Irish mafia. But the word from day one in my reporting memories was don't go near the Bulger thing, okay? But that's also just a version of what Johnny Power said. We're not going to talk about this. We got Al Capone, and we got Al Capone's brother, and there are other things to talk about.
Well, the exception, of course, is, if you have written, is Howie Carr from the Boston Herald, who
Amen.
Has gone after Bulger.
Another little point.
Nonstop.
I want to mention that, these books leave a lot out. They leave Howie out. He's not in the index. He's nowhere. The books are complicated, but I just want to go back to this rebranding of Whitey. He used to be the bad good guy. Then it dawned on me, no, he's our Osama bin Laden. He's the guy that the security forces adopted to go after the other guys. We'll buy Whitey, give him free rein, but we'll get the Italians, much as, the Reagan administration said, we'll adopt Osama bin Laden, and he'll help us drive the Russians out of Afghanistan. And then, poof, he's gone. They're gone. Well, I don't know. They're just unreliable guys. They did their job and disappeared, so we'll forget them. What's happening, I think, now, very significant in the way the FBI really orchestrates everything, and some higher power may do it even beyond them, is we're getting Whitey Bulger, not the bad altar boy anymore, but Kaiser Sose, out of that great movie Usual Suspects, but a man of such volcanic, indescribable, endless evil that we don't have to talk about who enabled him. He enabled himself.
We're talking to Christopher Lydon on Open Mic, and we're talking about both Bulgers, not just Whitey, but Bill. Go ahead, Marjorie.
I was going to say, get back to Billy, though, because there are legendary stories about Billy doing the bidding of Whitey Bulger. And one of the famous stories is the state trooper at Logan Airport.
Amen. That's an important story.
Tell people that story, because that's one of the examples.
Oh, to the chase, it's the demonstration of how Whitey Parr, through Bill, extended and took over people we thought were running things, like Bill Weld, former U.S., federal prosecutor, who had said that he had thought seriously of indicting both Bill and Whitey Bulger. It's a little like John Kerry saying he voted for and against the Iraq War. But he completely married Bulger on the campaign trail.
Not to mention appointing him president of the University of Massachusetts.
That was the end game to get him out of the Senate. But The real point was that Bill Bulger was used to writing the state budget, including punishing his enemies in the state budget, as in the George Dare case in the housing court. You remember the, you know.
He referred to, that judge referred to Bill Bulger as the, quote, corrupt midget,
well,
correct?
Well, the story was bigger than that in the sense that, you know, Bill Bulger did his sort of punitive damage to the housing court because George Dare wouldn't hire the clerk he wanted. And Mike Dukakis signed off on the punishments in the state budget. Pays froze and tried to destroy the housing court. And when Mike Dukakis is running for governor, for president in 1988, George Dare had the nerve to say, how's he going to stand up to the Russians if he can't stand up to the corrupt midget? Which gave White, you know, gave Howie Carr a line, the CM, the corrupt midget forever after. But go back to the Billy Johnson case, extremely important.
The state trooper.
He's a state.
Yeah, state trooper, Logan Airport. He sees Whitey Bulger is going to Montreal or someplace, comes through the you know, the I got TSA on my mind. You know, he puts his bag through. He's got a gym bag full of bricks of $100 bills. The alarm goes off or something. Billy Johnson comes running over, according to some reports, threw Whitey Bulger up against the wall and said, what the hell is going on? Whitey grabs the gym bag, tosses it to Kevin Weeks, and he's got the state trooper staring down, and there's, you know, the money is gone. So, you know, there must have been a family conference. What the hell happened to your trip, Whitey? And from the state house comes this inquiry about what was that state trooper doing to James Bulger? Who had the nerve? How did that happen? So Bill Bulger then famously cracked down on the upper executives of the state police until he got satisfaction. Bill Johnson was suddenly out of his job, and he ended up killing himself after crying for help, you know, in New Hampshire. I'm not sure there weren't other emotional issues. But the point was, suddenly Bill Weld is on my radio show talking about a very bad novel that he'd written. But I said, Governor, there is this matter of Billy Johnson. Can we talk about it? And he, you know, it was sort of deaf and dumb. These lips are sealed, which, of course, is poison in the radio business. Dead air is the worst imaginable thing. And I looked at him and said, Governor, I just asked you a question. And I said, before it was done, I said, you know, you're the commander-in-chief of the state troopers. This was your guy doing a public job, doing it well, I think. Are you, do you have nothing to say? Even sadness about the man's desperate
death?
What
did he say?
Nothing.
Deaf and dumb. Went on for 3-4 minutes.
Wow.
And again, there's a fear factor coming off both Bulgers that these books still can't deal with. We have a piece of tape that I'd love people to hear.
This is the Kevin White thing?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Do I need
set
to
set this up if you can, yeah.
You know, I used to interview Kevin White at some length at the end of every year, sort of review everything. What a
former talk. Mayor for you youngins out
yeah.
there, yes. Mayor of Boston,
16 years, a character, voluble, dramatic, self-dramatic. But we'd done a sort of review of everything, and we're, again, a little TV tech here. At the end, these interviews are shot with one camera, so you shoot the subject, then you re-ask the questions by the reporter, and then the Bobby Wilson of Channel 2, later Channel 5, went around getting wide shots to cover the edits. But our mics are still on, and Kevin saw, and I said to him, just by the by, you know, so Bill Bulger is about to become president of the state Senate. What do we think? And he went off. I mean, Kevin White was always going up. He said, it's you guys, you reporters, the press, the Globe, television, Channel 2, anything that bear the burden here. You don't have the guts. But anyway, he went off, and the tape lives and in a few places, and
here it is.
We can run it.
Let's play it. Here is Kevin White and Christopher Lydon.
I know what it is in the 75 fight to realize at the end, no, the mob was in the fight. A blind man knew that. And if they shot me, they win all the marbles. So why not shoot the son of a bitch? Do you know what it was for me? I'm not exaggerating. I realized in busing one night, I went over, came out of the, never went over again, came out of the club at the tennis club at 11 o'clock at night in the parking lot with my cat. I almost slept in the club. Because I figured if they pumped me out, which why not Whitey would be, they were crazy enough then to do it to me, then they drew Jerry O'Leary as council president.
By the way, if you ever see that video and you don't recognize the man with brown hair, that'd be Christopher Lydon in that particular time. And Chris, what's the? You say the story is not over for Bill Bulger, but it is over, is it not? He's got a pension of $200,000+. He is the emeritus president of the University of Massachusetts. He never got nabbed for what you pursued so brilliantly forever. On WGBH television about his involvement at 75 State Street.
With Tommy Trenchcoat, as I called him, David Bowery, who did a marvelous
brilliant
job
work.
Still doing it.
So why do you say it's not over? It seems to me that he lives out his life, he walks around Castle Island, and it's over.
Well, first of all, grant the man the torment of a very, very strange life. And I'm no
you
friend.
Saw torment. When you read the accounts, Chris, of him sitting in the front row when his brother was being arraigned after being captured in Santa Monica. Did you see any torment or read of any torment in Bill Bulger at all?
Look deeper. I mean, seriously, I'm no friend of Bill Bulger's, but we don't choose our brothers, and he didn't choose his. He learned how to use him, but he didn't choose him. What would you do growing up when your kid, your older brother, your example? For one thing, these books suggest that Whitey was severely beaten by their father. It's a much tenser, it's always been a tenser life than Bill Bulger ever lets on. But there he is, growing up behind this guy. What's he going to do? I don't approve of many of the things he did do, but of course he's in a difficult situation. I don't think he sleeps well. But hang on.
How can you say that? Listen to this and see if you, this is Bill Bulger.
I think he's in total denial.
Bill Bulger taking the fifth before the House Oversight Committee in December of 2002. This is when Bill Bulger was president of UMass. Listen to this brief bite.
One of the Fifth Amendment's basic functions is to protect innocent men who might be ensnared by ambiguous circumstances. I find myself in such circumstances and hence stand on my constitutional rights as advised by counsel.
Chris, his brother is a serial killer. I understand if your brother knocked off a bodega or something, you say, I love him, he's my brother, I grew up with him. He's an alleged, as Marjorie says, serial killer.
Absolutely. Bill Bulger is in some profound rut of denial. He's been in it all his life. God knows. I want to give him credit for suffering a very, very strange life. I have actually had a conversation with him years ago about The Brothers Karamazov. I mean, it may be the world's greatest novel. It's about murder. It's about brothers. It's about all kinds of anger and difficulty. It ends with salvation. Maybe Bill Bulger should have chosen to play the Alyosha role, the saintly kid who really did well. But this is at some Dostoevskian level, a family saga of great depth.
There are a bunch of calls, and we've held them. Let me just squeeze in a call for Chris Lydon about the Bulgers. Rick, you're in South Boston. You're on with Christopher Lydon. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you for having me on today.
Pleasure.
I know that voice.
How you doing, guys? How you doing?
Good.
I'm listening to this Bulger stuff, and I'm over here in South End, have been for years. And I always find it constantly amazes me, this fact with this Carmen Ortiz. U.S. attorney, exactly. She's going to, they're going after Jimmy Bulger, Whitey Bulger, specifically for the murders, but the racketeering cases that he was involved in, the corruption within the FBI office, all this other stuff. We're not going to go near that. We're not going to touch that. We're going to focus strictly on the murders because this is what we're going to get him on.
Rick, I would say that's part of the same narrowing of the story that you read in these books. We're being given a new narrative, what I call the Kaiser Sose narrative out of the movie Usual Suspects, Kevin Spacey. But a man so evil, so incredibly destructive, even in looking at people, looking at you, that we don't need any other detail here. We're not going to bother with everything else he did in town and what really doesn't matter. Are we talking about the same thing, sort of narrowing the story down so that we can get rid of it? We can get rid of the embarrassment over the years to the Globe, to the FBI, to the Federal Prosecutor's Office, to the whole Boston establishment. Remember, Bill Bulger got to sing a solo with the Boston Pops. He was on the board of the Mass General Hospital. He was, he was the darling little toy in a society that thought it was just so wonderful to have charming Billy on your board, and he has this gangster brother. And it's so Boston, so Irish, so quaint. I mean, they made the most of it. Back to you, Rick.
Right, well, actually not back to you, Rick, because we want to get one other call. Rick, thank you for your call. Very quickly, one other person who does not want to give their name, does want to talk
mystery,
to Chris Lydon.
He's our mystery guest.
Hey there. Welcome, whoever you are. Welcome.
Chris, hey, we know each other, and I'd love to talk to you about this some more. Maybe we could do it right now.
Go ahead.
What is still being missed is the depth of the corruption within the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office. You know, John Connolly is now, I think, sitting in Kansas as an accomplice to murder, but nobody, believes he was a loose cannon. Nobody who knows John Connolly and knows the FBI at that time believes that he was a loose cannon. I mean,
he was in love with Whitey Bulger at some level, I believe, and I think he was not a loose cannon, but are you saying he was representative of a FBI culture?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And it goes very, very deep. And the collusion was, you know, people within the FBI at the time knew that John Connolly had this extraordinary and probably criminal relationship with both Bulger brothers. You know, while he was at the FBI, I mean, after he left the FBI, you know, one of the first stops of a new rookie FBI agent in Boston was to be chaperoned by John Connolly up to meet not mm-hmm. Whitey, but Billy Bulger at the State House, his great friend.
Right.
You know, the big payoff to John Connolly was not any, you know, piece of change of cash. It was the job he got at NSTAR as the head of security.
On the Edison.
And then that wonderful...
Thanks for your call. We got to move, and thank you so much.
Can I just add, though, that wonderful line that Bill Bulger spoke at the FBI retirement dinner of John Connolly, where all these other young FBI recruits were there, and he put on his most sort of medieval, solemn tone, quoting Seneca.
Oh, God.
Saying, what was the line? It was basically that loyalty is the queen of all the human virtues. In other words, do it my way, as John Connolly always did. And Bulger could give off that line with all that sort of Latin pretentious, the most learned man that ever lived kind of air, with no sense of irony at all, that he was, in a certain sense, declaring his complicity in the whole game.
So, Chris, so you wanted to end with a quote. I'm going to end with a quote from you rather than Bill Bulger.
Uh-oh.
Chris Lydon said to me years ago when Bill Bulger's book, While the Music Lasts, came out, Chris Lydon said to me, it is the first book which will be remaindered before its release date. Christopher Lydon, it's great to see you. We'll see you next Thursday, Christopher
Pleasure
Lydon.
To be
and by
here,
the way,
Jim
the website and the address to find you 24/7 would be
www.radioopensource.org.
Thanks so much, Chris
Lydon.
Thank you very much,
Chris Lydon. He'll be here next Thursday at 1 o'clock. Tomorrow, 1 o'clock, open mic with our special guest, Laura Poza. She's written the inside track in the Boston Herald for a year. She is now leaving. Up next, what does it take to get the Boston Globe's Chris Muser to write an open letter about fashion? Well, stay tuned to Boston Public Radio. You will not believe what teen heartthrob Justin Bieber, Chris Lydon's favorite, is wearing now.